Morning, everyone, and good afternoon for those people back in Australia. Nick Coyle here in Beijing, along with Dan Boyer, Lachlan Cruz and Dean Morales. Can I firstly thank our speakers, Chris Tinning, Andrew Cox from MLA, and also Liu Bing, who's joining us from Shanghai Austrade. Thank you to all three, and thanks to all the team at the embassy for helping us put this on. Now, if you're listening in and if you have any technical problems at any stage, don't stress. We are recording this session. It will be on our website later on. So if you do run into any technical problems, you will be able to catch up later. We'll have it on our website probably by tomorrow morning. What else can I tell you? If you've got questions that you'd like to ask, if you've got me on WeChat, happily send them through to me directly. Otherwise, you can email them through to Daniel Waters, so daniel.waters at auschan.org. Danny is standing by with your questions to send to me. So, look, what we'll do is we'll get started right away. I'll hand over to Chris Tinning, who's joining us from Canberra. He's going to give us an update on COVID-19, also touch on the bushfires, and also might even have a little bit of a chat about some of the US-China trade stuff and how it might impact things. So over to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Nick, and thanks for the opportunity, and hello, everyone. So my name's Chris Tinning. I head a division in Canberra that looks after trade and market access issues in the Department of Agriculture, Water and Environment. My division has about 100 staff in Canberra, and we've got a team of overseas counsellors who sort of help on the front line in terms of advancing Australian exports. One of those counsellors is on the line, Dean Merrilies. We also work very closely with DFAT and with Austrade, and we've got colleagues from DFAT and Austrade on the line as well. We've got Dan and Lachlan. And part of our whole-of-government approach we take to Australian exports is to throw hard questions at each other. So any hard questions will be answered by Dan and Lachlan and or Dean. So, look, it's pretty interesting times for us at the moment, obviously, with COVID-19. And I thought maybe I'd start just by painting some of the context for the Australian ag sector, and that context is important, I think, in terms of how we are thinking about the COVID-19 response. So we had our annual outlook of Australian agriculture led by our Bureau of Resource Economics last week, and they sort of painted a bit of a picture of Australian agriculture, and they highlighted the farm productions at $59 billion, which is slightly down from previous years, but still remarkably resilient given some of the challenges we faced in the Australian agriculture sector in recent years. The value of exports is about 11% down on last year at about $43 billion, and that largely reflects the impact of the drought. And the drought is reflected in the fact that rainfall in the wheat and sheep zones of Australian agriculture was in the lowest 10 percentile of rainfall over the past 100 years for two consecutive years in 2018 and 2019, and that's the first time that's happened since the turn of the last century. It's been a very severe drought that's affected Australian agriculture, and crop production has been down 49% over those 2 years. So that's been a major hit to Australian exports. We've also got the lowest number of beef cattle in Australia since 1990 and the lowest number of sheep since the turn of the last century. So that's been a pretty big hit for on the supply side for exports. But fortunately, prices have been very strong. And a large part of that price story is the demand in Asia. And we've seen very healthy prices, particularly for red meat. So we've seen 77% rise in the price of chilled beef and frozen meat over the last 12 months in China. And that's obviously got to do with demand issues of the China end, and obviously the impact of ASF. We're pretty, the forecast suggests we're going to rebound in terms of some of the sort of stock issues, but it's going to take a while to restock in terms of animals, and we're pretty hopeful that the crop story will rebound pretty sharply this year. We're starting to see rain. In fact, today in Canberra is probably more rain today than we've had in the last 3 months combined. So there's plenty of happy happy farmers around us at the moment. So that sort of drought story that's impacted on Australian supply is part of the story. Another is obviously the global context, and we're very conscious of the fact that you know, there are some challenges in terms of global agricultural trade. Everyone knows what's happening in the WTO in terms of the challenges of getting anything moving on agricultural trade reform. We're obviously seeing rising non-tariff barriers in some parts of agriculture. And again, that's sort of part of the overall context for Australian agriculture that's fed into the where we are now with the coronavirus. Now, China, as I'm sure everyone knows, is an absolutely central market for our agriculture exports. It's about 29% of our agriculture exports go to China, and some commodities are very heavily dependent on the China market. So about 70+% of our wool exports go to China, about 40% of wine, 35% of cotton, 50% of barley, 47% of wood products. That's a pretty high concentration of some of those export products on the China market. And there's obviously very good reasons for that. The very large size of the China market, the very good prices that some of those commodities get in China. And obviously the free trade agreement we signed in 2014 has been very beneficial to increasing trade flows. So that's sort of some of the context, the sort of challenges domestically on supply, the very high concentration of some of our exports into China. So in that context, we're obviously watching the impact of the COVID-19 very closely. We're tracking, obviously, demand from China, and conscious of the fact that demand's fallen pretty rapidly, particularly at the high end. So we've seen some fairly sharp hits to some of the premium products, such as seafood, particularly lobsters. Some of our horticulture industry, particularly table grapes, has seen significant falls in demand. And while in recent days we've seen some rebound, I think our industry groups are reporting some rebound in that demand, prices are still well below what they were pre COVID-19. Obviously, more broadly across the agriculture sector, we're facing significant challenges in terms of transportation. So those products that have been reliant on air freight are facing particular challenges. We've seen sharp increases in prices and falls in our capacity to use air freight. And obviously, we've got challenges in terms of port congestion, so getting products in. And obviously the fall in manufacturing continues to be an ongoing challenge for some industries, including wool. So I think it's fair to sort of say that our industry at the moment's certainly conscious of the challenges they're facing across those range of fronts, but I don't think they're in panic mode at all. We've got, I think, some industries that are very resilient and focused on the long-term opportunities in China and very willing to ride out the tough times, but they're obviously wanting us as a government to do as much as we can to alleviate those challenges, and they're working with their industry counterparts to get through this particularly challenging time. So I might leave it there for the moment, but I'm more than happy to go into further detail during Q&A.
Terrific. Thanks, Chris. So, as I said, guys, if you've got questions, please either flick them through to me if you've got me on WeChat or to Daniel Waters. I'll just remind people there, that's Daniel, D-I-N-D-A-N-I-E-L, Waters, W-A-T-E-R-S, at auschamp.org. And I'll hand over to Liu Bing in Shanghai from Austrade.
Thank you, Nick. In Shanghai here, I have myself and also we have Sevatai and Yvonne Lee, who are our agribusiness and food and beverage experts. So they are our source of information. For my talk, I'm just going to split into three parts. One is the impact of the coronavirus outbreak on the industry. The second part will be some of the trends and opportunities we see for the agribusiness sector. And then I'll briefly mention about the Festival of Australia, which is in train to happen this year. So some impact in general about the virus. There's a strong evidence this week of China returning to work outside of Hubei province. But even the traffic jams have returned to normal and transportation congestion is being reported, but there are still indicators of economic activity, especially power consumption, remain well below seasonal averages. Small and medium-sized enterprises in particular are struggling, despite announcement of subsidized finance and tax breaks by various governments. China's province have moved from complete lockdown virus control mode to now recovery with restrictions, particularly in those major cities, across those cities, Shanghai, Beijing, and Guangdong. Interprovincial transport has resumed in many places, deemed low risk, and Wuhan, as the epicenter of the virus outbreak, and Beijing as the capital are the exceptions, as we also see some indications that the rest of the Hubei province is planning to return to work commencing from next week, 10th of March. The Chinese Manufacturing Purchase Managers Index, PMI, numbers reported by the Chinese National Bureau of Statistics, February over the weekend show a staggering drop to 35.7 in February, from 50.1 in January. The non-manufacturing PMI, largely services, dropped even more to 29.6, reflecting the significant medium-term issues faced by the hospitality and food chains, traffic retail industries here. Hard data on consumption is not yet available, but we can see consumption, particularly in retail, tourism, food services, entertainment, are down heavily. We are just seeing some restaurants started to open this week, but with very, very small number of customers at tables. In terms of the agri and food and beverage sector, the key impact are in two key areas, the demand shock and logistic difficulties in getting products to their customers. The hospitality industry continued to feel the brunt of the decline in consumer demand. The Ministry of Commerce report that 57% of large chain restaurants have reopened. However, many of these were operating delivery-only services. Over 100,000 restaurants start new delivery operations to manage the loss, including some luxury hotel brands like Shangri-La, Western, for the first time doing food delivery services. Hilton report that they expect a $20 to $50 million impact on 2020 gross earnings. Marriott International closed 90 of its 375 China hotels. Reported 90% loss of revenue in February year on year, while Airbnb has suspended all Beijing bookings through to the end of April. Morton Steakhouse closed down one of its restaurants in Shanghai permanently. Most restaurant owners we contact indicate that their cash flow could probably last no more than 2 to 3 months. E-commerce is picking up some of the declines, but not enough. Tencent News report that overall e-commerce platform in China has seen a 350% increase in grocery sales over the course of the coronavirus outbreak. Products sold understandably would be quite different for home cooking and food services. Despite reduced demand and large stock of import products, MLA reports that beef prices have held up post-Chinese New Year, despite values being down quite markedly. The demand broadly for seafood exports remain low, with prices depressed and no immediate sign of improvement, because high-end seafood like lobsters and abalone is mostly often sold into upscale hotels and for banquets and special events like weddings, meaning there is no easy e-commerce option for sales to home to replace this order. We expect demand to take weeks, if not months, rather than days to rebuild. Commodity and live cattle import are less impacted by the virus outbreak, partly due to the large orders placed before the Chinese New Year holiday, and new shipments are only arriving from March. Some logistical issues are the key challenges for most Australian product importers. Best estimates from the port officials and importers suggest that Chinese ports are operating at somewhere between 50-70% capacity down, but improving each week or every day. It's due to a lack of waterfront labor, fewer available drivers, and the maintenance of inter-provincial travel restrictions. The most affected products continue to be perishable foods, with refrigerator containers and power outlets in short supply. Refrigerated container yards and Ningbo, Tianjin, and Shanghai are particularly at capacity, but it's easing. And we have heard reports that ships have previously been turned away and asked to dock at other ports without the same issues. We have seen encouraging signs in the last few days around port operations, with Shanghai port this week resume almost normal transportation arrangements, with Donghai Bridge, the bridge connecting the Yangshan port to the city, detected around 9,000 trucks per day at this last Friday, close to normal levels. Other ports like Dalian have moved to continuous 24-hour unloading and clearance with streamlined entry processes. Our guess is that port operations will back to normal by mid or late March, although the ripple effects across the global logistics industry may take some time to wash through. International flights to and from China continue to decline, with scheduled operating capacity for March down by 66.8% year-on-year. Qantas, FedEx and UPS continue to operate regular cargo flights between Australia and China, however, not able to meet the demand. According to some high-end retailers, with air freight costs increased by 60% in market and retail price capped by the government, retailers are reluctant to sell import fresh produce, which includes some Australian producers. With the cancellation or delay of industry events, many companies have to reschedule activities, and some of our Australian peak bodies also advised to cancel their trips to China because of these cancellations. Some of the new trends and opportunities. With the recent African swine flu outbreak, the new ban on wild animal trade in wet markets and in markets in general, and increasing consumer awareness of food safety issues, we anticipate further increased demand on import protein, expanding from the first and second tiers nowadays to other even lower tier cities. Demand for import food products such as wheat flour, beef, UHT meal, fresh meal powder, infant formula, canned food, health supplements, and functional food will continue to increase. Continued innovation in food sector will see Australian commodities in high demand. For example, with oat, we see diversified end product applications, including cereal bars, oat drinks, and other snacks being very popular. And with various healthy clients and marketing, we'll see increased demand for Australian oat in market. Second, with anti-corruption campaign, we are seeing many new liquid SKUs targeting young generation with appealing labels and selling messages, replacing the old traditional liquid production, which is currently in decline. So certainly, we still anticipate increased demand in China. malting barley. There's increasing demand from domestic breweries adding craft beer into their production to meet the incoming summer demand. So malting barley is also still very much in strong demand. And Australian hay and China's dairy and cattle industry are still largely relied on imports. A sector we see small change or no change in the medium to long term, so Australian hay product will remain in high demand. Australian agri-technology to assist China with agriculture industry upgrade modernization is another opportunity we see. China's total food import in 2019 reached $150 billion, a minor 0.3% decrease compared with 2018 financial year. Top three categories are oil seeds, meat, seafood, and grain cereal. China is currently a major net import nation for agri and food products. The government has put in strategies in transforming, upgrading, and modernizing its own agriculture industry to be more efficient, cost-effective, and sustainable. Major efforts are seen to be focusing on developing agricultural technologies, for example, soil remedy using organic soluble fertilizer, genetic technology for better species, precision farming with Internet of Things, blockchain and traceability, drones for plant protection, etc. Australia is working with Australian companies, industry bodies and local R&D institutes and key market players on a range of technology consultation and R&D projects. We encourage more Australian equipment, technology and services companies in the agribusiness technology area to explore opportunities in China. Here I also like to mention some new phenomena we detected over the coronavirus outbreak, which could be interesting to everyone. On 15th of February, these 340 petrol stations in Beijing, Sinopec started to sell fresh vegetable package at 99 RMB per 7 kilo package, which include 10 varieties of fresh vegetable and 10 eggs. It is designed for a family of three to consume for 3 days. Can be picked up when people are filling petrols in their cars or just go direct to the store to buy. And the other one was the franchise snack food store, Event, also start to sell fresh fruit and vegetable in its 1,000 stores in Shanghai. With online pre-order, then customers can pick up at their store at a nearby snack stores, which reduce any contact with the general public during the outbreak. We see well-established distribution channels assist enterprises adapt quickly in unpredicted changes in the market. So distribution channels are also very, very important in terms in events like this. We also want to share some local government supports if you are actually operating in China or exporting to China. And during the outbreak, many levels of government have instated many measures and policies to support businesses across many range of industries for it to return to work or facilitate its business. The Shanghai government has guaranteed a green channel to imports with relevant stuff like medical resources, equipment, as well as anything that relates to public living in terms of groceries, fresh vegetables, meats, feedstocks, to achieve to be able to be cleared quickly. And though it probably still take a period of the application time and the services congestion and major ports probably will ease very quickly anyway. The ports support are also giving incentives to waive warehouse charges to importers who can take their containers away by themselves and arranging trucks, and that the fees within the 90 days of clearance are waived. So lastly, but not least, we are talking about the Festival of Australia. Many people probably still concerned about, still very interested in participating in the Festival of Australia in 2020. Our original date was in mid-May to mid-June, which probably looks like it is unlikely to happen with our physical events, and we think that returning to normal. Many of the events held by Chinese governments are announcing the event to be delayed or postponed to a later day. So we are looking at a new date to be able to include more industry bodies and more industries, sectors and companies to participate in the Festival Australia, and also to engage with our Chinese customers and business and communities as the first batch to re-engage into the market as quick as possible, as soon as possible. So we are working with our teams on shore and also the minister in terms of designing a new date that is suitable to relaunch our activities in China. So please, if you want to be kept in touch, please send us your details, so I will keep you in touch or keep you updated with the progress of the Festival Australia. I think that's all from me. Thank you.
Thanks, Bing. That was really good. Now I'll just hand over to Andrew Cox, who's in Singapore from MLA, and we'll get a bit of an industry perspective, especially around red meat. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Good morning, all. And as Chris said, the word interesting, I think, sums it up. So it's been a very interesting start to the year for the Australian beef and lamb industry, to say the least. We've had trade deals, changes to existing trade blocks. We've had highly unpredictable weather situation, ongoing droughts, obviously the unprecedented bushfires, and more recently some floods and widespread rain. And of course the COVID-19 virus situation, which is impacting us now in Asia and elsewhere. So of course I'll focus on COVID-19, but I will touch on some of those other issues because in terms of our supply and demand, they're all sort of linked together. So as everyone knows, the virus hit China as it was preparing for the Lunar New Year, which is the peak consumption period for imported beef and lamb. So there was an unprecedented amount of red meat entering China in Q4, so cold stores were full in anticipation of increased sales. Once the lockdown came into effect after the Chinese New Year, consumer demand was, of course, heavily impacted, so particularly in food service, of course. So demand has collapsed. Over 90% of restaurants shut their doors. And statistics by China Cuisine Association indicates 78% of the food service industry lost about 100% of their revenue, 9% more than 90%. Since last week, as somebody else mentioned, food service businesses have been allowed to reopen, but still with hardly any customers. So some of them have been able to sell their produce through online delivery platforms instead. Definitely, in terms of our the impacts for our industry, our food service customers have been the most affected from this issue. Retail has been more of a mixed bag. Majority of people have switched to home cooking. So supermarkets and grocery stores have generally enjoyed a sharp rise in sales of fresh produce, including red meat. Online platforms such as HemaFresh, MissFresh and Ding Dong have greatly outperformed the traditional big bricks and mortar retailers. Also, people are generally sticking to the staples, so cuts of beef and lamb that are suited to Chinese cooking have been much more popular than the more discretionary items such as steak. And then looking at trade, distribution, etc., a large issue, of course, has been that demand cannot always be met. So labour shortage, restrictions on movement have impacted the entire supply chain. So importers, distributors, wholesalers, value-added food companies, retailers and food service customers have not had sufficient labour. That's led to severe disruption in the supply chain. It's particularly affected ports, of course, that have become clogged with containers and with no lorry drivers to distribute the product, particularly Shanghai and Tianjin, which account for 3/4 of all inbound Australian beef. So they've been severely affected. There's a shortage of plugs for reefer containers, and that's restricted any newly landed products. So some exporters needed to reroute products, et cetera, to other markets. And one issue, of course, has been not just fresh chilled frozen beef supply chain, but a lot of processing facilities that use Australian beef and lamb as ingredients in processed food have simply not had enough labour to operate. So that's restricted the flow of that channel as well. In the last week, that issue has thankfully begun to subside. People returning to work in greater numbers. The backlog of products has started moving through ports and coal stores. However, there's a global imbalance in reefer containers locked up in China that will take weeks to disperse and correct. For Australian meat exporters, the situation certainly has been very concerning. But we should also note that our industry is less reliant on China than a lot of other industries. We have a large domestic market. We have a highly diversified export market. China is our largest single red meat market, but it does only account for less than 20% of our beef production and about a quarter of our sheep meat production. And in terms of quantifiable impacts on trade, it's really hard to quantify at this point in time. Obviously, February data, which relies on January purchasing, it was not heavily impacted in a quantifiable way, but obviously we'll keep a very close eye on data that's coming out for March exports. Also, of course, post-Chinese New Year is always the slowest time for export sales, and as I mentioned earlier, we've seen a redirection of some product away from China towards other markets, which showed up in the February data a little bit, but not in a highly significant way. And obviously our industry is watching the situation now in Japan and in Korea with some trepidation, as along with China, those three North Asian markets account for 60% of our beef and 36% of our sheep meat exports. And further down the supply chain, of course, we're especially concerned about any widespread outbreak in Australia and how it could impact our processing sector, which is actually the largest manufacturer in Australia. That sector is obviously already grappling with reduced availability of packaging materials sourced from China and the rising freight costs, which I think Chris mentioned earlier, due to flight cancellations and that lack of reefer containers. Then, of course, COVID-19 came on the back of the bushfires, and we've been very active in our international markets to reassure overseas customers that our production has not been overly impacted. Bushfires occurred mostly in forest areas, and obviously disastrous for native animals, but they did not significantly affect our livestock population or our processing capabilities. Less than 1% of Australia's livestock grazing country was affected by the fires. The more significant issue for our industry in terms of supply has been the significant drought in eastern Australia in the last 18 months. And we have, however, had recent rainfall in drought-affected areas, and that's encouraging on the macro level, long-term level, because it allows the commencement of herd and flock rebuilding. But the flip side for our international competitive in the short to medium term is a period of high livestock prices, and beef and lamb livestock prices are currently at or near record levels. So just to conclude, there's a number of issues, obviously, that impact our exports to China. It's been a particularly disruptive situation for our customers, especially our food service customers. The fundamentals are strong, and we remain very upbeat about the opportunities for a large and sustainable export presence in China. And that's obviously built around the strong trust and affinity that consumers have for Australian beef and lamb. And then the only other thing I'd note is from a market development and market investment perspective, we've obviously been in a little bit of a holding pattern in China and across Asia now. Our staff are back at work, but we are not able to initiate most of our marketing programs, seminars, events, trade shows, and consumer work. So we have deferred some of our expenditure, but we have been able to defer that into the next financial year. So overall, we plan to continue to invest, and as soon as we're able to, we'll pick up those demand-building activities as soon as the COVID-19 situation clears up. So hopefully that provides a summary from our situation and our perspective. Thanks very much for having me on the webinar.
Terrific. Thanks very much for that. Now, look, we'll get to some Q&A. If I've got specific questions for our panellists, I'll let them know. And I've got a few that are, I've got a couple that I think are, and then a few that are a bit general. So we'll kick off probably touching on something that that all of you have talked a little bit about, but looking forward, that if and when businesses reopen and things return to normal from China, what lasting changes do you think we'll see as a result of the COVID-19 event? And who will I put under the gun first? Chris, maybe.
Well, I'm reluctant to make any definitive comments because I don't think any of us know exactly how this is going to play out, not only in China but across the globe. So I think one thing that probably it has done for Australia, I mentioned before the fact that a lot of our export industries are heavily reliant on the China market. I guess in the case of some of them, there'll be some sort of reflection on whether they're too exposed to the China market, but I think China, regardless, will remain a very important market for most of our commodities. But maybe in the case of some of them, they'll be thinking a little more about their sort of NBs. So that maybe that's one long-term change. But in terms of, and maybe there'll be sort of some reflection about global supply chains and whether there's sort of an over-reliance on in some industries on those, and whether there's sort of a need to have more than a few days worth of stock. We've currently got a panic in Australia about toilet paper shortages. So I think sort of supply chains around the world are at the moment pretty reliant on no disruptions, and maybe there'll be some reflection in some industries, including the agriculture industry, around whether we're too reliant on sort of real-time transportation movements, et cetera. So there are a couple of early thoughts, but maybe my colleagues want to add.
Well, I'll throw to Lachlan. I know he's got a bit of an opinion on this one. And I might, one, I'll get you to touch on that, Lachlan. And then the other thing I was thinking too is that, I mean, we hope we don't see this sort of event happening again, but there's every chance that it might. Are there things we can do? And I might throw that over to Andrew. I'll get Lachlan to answer this one, then Andrew, have a think about it. I'll give you some time. What can we do to prepare better next time?
So on the sort of medium to long-term challenges question, I think medium-term, what we're starting to see, I think, is that, and Bing mentioned this in her comments, many of the most impacted sector in the Chinese economy is going to be the SME sector. Many of those businesses just cannot survive no cash flow for sort of 6 to 8 weeks, which is what we've seen over the last little while, and some of them haven't resumed operations yet. So I think we can expect to see a lot of consolidation at the small end of the market, and over the next 6 to 12 months, that will continue to flow through the economy even after the viral situation is recovered. So you'll see lower wages and subdued demand probably in China for the rest of 2020 as a result of that. The second thing is probably a bit more obvious, that I've heard it said that SARS back in 2003 was responsible for kicking off the extraordinary growth of e-commerce in China that's seen it account for about 30% of retail sales here now. And I think this event will just lead to a second wave of enhanced e-commerce presence in the market. Again, Bing said some things about, you know, brands are getting into e-commerce that you would not associate with that platform of delivery. And just the convenience and the safety of e-commerce will be ramped up in the minds of Chinese consumers for some time yet.
And Andrew and Chris or Bing, you might have a view on this too. What can we do? You know, if we do, okay, we had SARS 17 years ago, or there or thereabouts. We've had this incident. You know, let's think this, you know, as we're more and more interconnected, these things are going to be more and more difficult to control. I think that's one of the things that we've seen. What can we do to prepare better next time? Andrew, I'll see if you've got a view.
I was going to try and remain silent on that one. I think it's probably too early to tell. I do pick up the point about reliance. I think it's important for businesses, the commercial players, to have diversified export markets. So I think wise exporters have a number of customers globally in our industry, which it's basically risk mitigation. So, and that's a common trait of smart exporters, I think. So it's not necessarily responsive to any particular situation, but a lot of markets contain economic risk, political risk, and commercial risks. So you need to spread that risk by having a diversified export market. And I think, that in some ways people have to respond to where the customers are, but I do think the exporters that are in for the long haul are stoking demand in a variety of different places so that they can deal with a shock in one market and they've got other customers, and I think that's just smart business. I think also probably it's easy to overstate the long-term impacts of this particular issue that we're dealing with at the moment. I think Lachlan's right. You've got demand lost, which cannot be recovered now. So in terms of food service sector, et cetera, bricks and mortar operators, if they've lost that demand, they've lost cash flow, which cannot be recovered. A lot of places have shut their doors, and those who will be able to pick up the demand when it springs back are most likely those who have are geared towards fast expansion. So that probably helps franchises, of course, more than small independents. And then there is new channels now. There's new entrepreneurs who set up new business models of online sales, and obviously they'll want to remain in business, so they'll be now pushing and agitating for market share. So I don't think there's a huge structural change that will occur as a result of this issue, but certainly there's some impacts that will hasten the drift towards online retail, etc.
Hi, Nick. Can I try to answer this question? Just so I think for long-term impacts, I'm not quite... I think if there is certainly for the next few years, Chinese consumers will be very much focusing on health, to be healthy, and the health awareness of being healthy is going to be on the rise. So any products and contribute to their health in probably more than normal will pick up pace. And on the second one about what we're going to do better, I think diversification is the word come to my mind. I think either if you have a single product, maybe you want to consider diversifying to other markets, more markets. If you have ability to develop a bigger product range, then you can diversify into more products. So you don't rely on one single sector, one single revenue, for example, food services to sell your products, then you probably hit very hard.
Oh. Hi, great. I think Dan, you've actually just got a really good point, so if you want to explain.
I was just going to add to that. I think your point's a really good one being about, and I would say that because you know we're both Australian, but the point about diversification in product line is an important one, but so too is the point about diversifying within China. China, tend to regard China as a bit of a monolith, but we're seeing even now that some provinces are getting back to work a lot quicker than other provinces and have been more badly, some have been less affected than other provinces. And so having, the opportunity to sell into different parts of China is actually something that you can do to look at diversifying your China position as well.
Great. Thank you. Now, look, another topic that's come up time and time again, especially recently, is looking at US, China, Australia, phase one, import substitution. All of these are fairly important issues. Lachlan, have you got a bit of an update or a bit of a perspective there?
Look, thanks, Nick. I might just talk very briefly about the kind of tariff impact of the phase one China-US deal. The deal itself, of course, didn't do anything to the tariffs between the two countries, but in association with it, both sides have scaled back their tariff walls, particularly for the more recent rounds. About 2 weeks ago, the Ministry of Finance here put out a list of commodities for which Chinese firms can seek exemption from China's retaliatory tariffs. So these are the tariffs that China has put in over the last couple of years on U.S. imports in response to the U.S. Section 301 tariff actions. There are a number of agricultural commodities on the list of products that are eligible for those exemptions. Beef is on them. Pork, obviously not an Australian export at the moment. Cotton is on the list. There are a number of dairy items, including infant formula, and there's some horticulture there as well. So quite a broad range of products, including lobster. What that means essentially is that if Chinese companies are successful in getting the exemption from those tariffs, they will be more competitive in China compared to where they were before. I think it's important to note, though, that if they get exemption from those tariffs, that just takes them back to where they were before the trade war started. So they still get most favoured nation tariff equivalent. So, for example, in red meat, between 12 and 25%, depending on the cut. Because of the China-Australia Free Trade Agreement, Australia still has now tariff-free access for almost everything into China, red beef and milk powder being the exception. So the phase one deal and the tariff cuts that have kind of gone along with it mean that all things being equal, the US is more competitive in China than it was before in agriculture, but it's still got a bit of catching up to do in terms of competitiveness with Australia.
What about the commitments to buy a certain amount of US products?
The commitments to purchase, so as part of the deal, China has said that it will buy $200 billion worth of US goods over and above a 2017 baseline. Because the deal has only been in for a few weeks, it came into force on the 14th of February. It's a bit too early to read too much into what the impact of the virus will be. Different figures in the US administration have said different things. Some have said we expect China to comply fully. Others have indicated a level of flexibility. Obviously, we recognise that China's going through a difficult time. There are mechanisms in the deal, particularly on agriculture, to time the commitments and the purchase targets according to conditions. There are commitments in there about all purchases being made on a market basis. And if things get really bad, there's sort of an exceptional circumstances provision where if there's in the event of a natural disaster, and you could consider this event to be a natural disaster from a certain point of view, the parties can seek consultations to decide whether or not they need to set some commitments aside. But I don't think we're quite at that point yet on the deal.
Well, I'll do another follow-up. Prior to all of this happening, what was your read on what you think those commitments might mean for Australian agriculture? Were you expecting some substitution?
I think it's important to say, first of all, that we were happy to see the deal come in. I mean, it provides a level of certainty for countries exporting to China and indeed into the US about what to expect over the next couple of years. So the deal is mostly a good thing. In terms of what it might mean for competitiveness, yes, obviously it will give the US an advantage in certain areas. Part of that is the tariff reductions outside the deal that I've already talked about, but there's also a range of commitments in there on the processes and the protocols and the procedures for importing agriculture from the US. And to talk about that, I might ask either Chris or Dean from Agriculture to make a comment.
Chris, do you want to kick off first, or I'm happy to?
Yeah, sure. So maybe a couple of things to note. One is that quite a few of the US commodities most likely to sort of come in under the US-China trade deal, Australia doesn't have access to the China market, so soybeans and pork, for instance, we don't export to China at the moment. Another point is sort of quite a few of the seasonal products that we export, such as horticulture products, quite often it's counter-seasonal with the US, so there's sort of not direct competition there with US products. So there are a couple of factors that I think that mitigate the impact of any additional access by the US.
I might just add a little bit. So a lot of the gains that the US have in agriculture are really gains in a technical sense, gains commitments to timelines, to publish establishment lists, and commitments to on things like HGPs, and also to review the use of ractopamine. The positive that from Australia on some of that is that it confirms our approach in terms of seeing a more science-based approach to some of the technical issues. I think we've heard very clearly from our industries the desire to have parity on the timelines for the publishing of establishments and things like that. One of the challenges we've had here recently, of course, is to get some of those things done, publishing of dairy and meat establishment lists. So I think the other thing that is within that US commitments is that they talked a lot more about recognition of the US systems, and that's a big step forward. Australia, like every other country, will be seeking to get the same outcomes for our industry. So there are some positives there in the announcements, but as Lachlan and and Chris are saying, the direct competition, I think, in the short term is a little bit different. The challenge for us will be to move forward and get the same outcomes on some of those technical protocol issues. I think there's a couple of things there. We're just still doing quite a lot of analysis, and some of it is a little bit oversold in our view. And I'll use dairy as an example of that. They have got some time commitments on dairy establishments, but our read is that they have not yet got the outcomes that we want in terms of actual registration, for example, of dairy infant formula. And no doubt the US will pursue those in phase two, just as we're continuing to pursue that for our own industries and exporters.
Yeah, so you mentioned, obviously, you know, there's going to be new protocols negotiated with the US, and obviously there's a range of industries from Australia that have been looking at new protocols. Pork, you mentioned rectopamine, that's one of those industries. So, you know, do we think sort of the negotiations for new protocols between Australia and China, do we think that's going to have much of a positive impact on, or much of an impact on some of the industries from Australia who have been looking to negotiate those protocols as well?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. There's a couple of things for us. One, of course, is that Chinese agencies, GAC and SAMR, that are involved in these have limited resources, so there may be some short-term impact in that we can see from the early delivery of some of the US outcomes that they're clearly prioritising within the Chinese system at this stage, resourcing and effort into those. That is a risk for us and every other trading partner, is to make sure that our priorities continue to get attention from Chinese authorities. But there are, as I said, some really broad opportunities for us to pursue, and the equivalence of our system would be a major step forward, for example, in meat, where currently really they're looking at establishment by establishment registration. If we can get recognition of our meat, our dairy, our seafood systems, that would be a major step forward for us as Chris said at the outset, a very large trading partner into China.
I guess standards recognition is the holy grail, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I've got a question for Andrew. You talked a little bit about diversification, or hinted at that. What about MLA? What are you guys doing in terms of looking at your sort of marketing investment as a promotion body? Are you guys looking at Southeast Asia and other markets outside of China as a priority for you guys over the next, you know, 6 or 12 months? Or are you thinking, you know, this will be a short-term issue and it won't really change your strategy too much?
Probably the latter, but it's hard to answer at the moment, obviously. The longer we cannot execute marketing programs, the harder it gets to pick it up later. But, I mean, fundamentally, we're heavily committed to developing the markets in China. But we've got a diversified budget, like I mentioned before, so we need to continue to support our developed and mature markets with promotional campaigns where we've got significant brand equity. So obviously Japan and Korea are those markets for us and our domestic market. And then as other markets develop, they attract more business development funds and people. But however, we have a finite budget, so we can't. The one thing we've been discussing is we're unable to, as markets develop, we're unable to support them in the way that we have traditionally in Japan and Korea because we simply don't have enough funds. So short term, we're not reallocating funds to other markets because even in South Asia, we have some of the similar issues. FHA trade show here in Singapore has been postponed until next year. We've got a lot of exporters have just across the board flight restrictions and travel restrictions. So we're unable to sort of switch. Even Japan and Korea, we've got big issues there with our ability to run events and seminars. So it's an Asia-wide issue for us, not just a China issue. And it's increasingly possible that it will become an issue in the US and Europe as well, all the cold countries. So we're just keeping a watching brief, but we have been able to defer some of our activities. Honestly, I think the long-term fundamentals don't change. The biggest issue and topic for our industry before COVID-19 was obviously the Asian swine fever and in pork, and we've got huge market opportunity there in the medium term, we believe, in China, and that that fundamental still exists. And then the other fundamental is the growing middle class in, across China and the increased demand likely for our products from that. So because of those fundamentals, we're not at all reviewing our investment in the medium term into China.
Well, talking about pork, I know that there's ATLs on the webinar. Any update for pork? Because I mean, I've had this range of different people talk to me about this, the opportunities that are obviously present in the pork industry, given the challenges over here at the moment, and then also poultry. Yeah.
So perhaps on pork, I can say our focus at the moment is on things like semen and reproductive products rather than our produce at the moment, because we think that's an opportunity that we can pursue more readily. So that's certainly a high focus at the moment. I think poultry, again, we don't have access here, and that's probably, to be frank, a little bit down the list just at the moment.
Right. And I've got another question, Andrew. We heard a few people talk about it, I mean, being touched on at Lachlan. E-commerce, is that going to be an increasing priority for MLA looking at investing more into that area?
Yeah, I mean, it already has been, because Chinese pickup of technology in retail has been very rapid, and we therefore, if you look at what we're doing in China versus some of our other markets, we're quite heavily involved in some of those online channels. So we've got to pick and choose our battles in China, so we're not across the entire spectrum and working with every single channel and customer. But yeah, already the team in China, MLA team, have got a number of projects with online retailers, and that will continue.
Okay, terrific. Dean?
I think we just had an online question about a little bit more update on some of our semen and reproduction. We have had, due to mainly COVID-19, a delay on the audit of some of our existing registered establishments, and we've certainly had a commitment from GATT that they will continue to allow exports from those establishments. The registrations expire at the end of April, so we're working to make sure we've got all the preparatory material for the audit as soon as that can occur. The Chinese government, as many of you are aware, also has travel restrictions on its officials, so the auditors won't be able to travel to Australia in the near term, but we are doing the preparatory work. And as I said, the commitment from GATT means that we can continue to trade, if necessary, beyond the end of April, which is when the current registrations expire.
Well, terrific. So many bad jokes I could have made with that subject line there, but I won't. Look, we're coming up on the hour, so I might just go around the room for sort of any last comments. Chris?
No, just to say thank you very much for the opportunity, and look forward to future webinars. Thanks very much.
Pleasure. Thank you. Bing?
Yeah, thank you all very much for participating, and look forward to seeing you all in market when this is all over.
Terrific. Thank you. Andrew?
Yeah, nothing more from me. Thanks for having me. And as Bing invited me, as soon as I can, I'll be over in China and working with our guys to grow demand for Australian beef and lamb.
Wonderful. Well, I'm sure we'll all be very excited to see you, because that means life's returning to normal. Thank you to everyone on the call. Just a reminder for any of you, if you had any technical problems, this will be up on our website shortly. We will be hosting regular webinars, especially over the coming weeks until things get back to normal. And so keep an eye on our website, auschamp.org, for upcoming details. We'll endeavour to get any presentations and links and follow-up info on our website from this session. So check back. There'll be a sort of an event review page, which will have all of those relevant links. And we'll also have the recording of this session on there as well. But look, everyone, thank you. Keep safe. Good luck. And let's hope life gets back to normal soon. And have an excellent afternoon.
Cheers.
Thanks, all.